When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Here at Cbus Super, over the next 3 years, we're investing $1 billion into Cbus property.
Building high-quality, sustainable developments around Australia.
And creating healthy long-term investments for members like me to enjoy in retirement. Cbus. For all of us.
To consider if Cbus is right for you, go to cbussuper.com.au for a PDS.
I had to go about it.
Is the Final Word Cricket Podcast with Jeff Lemon and Adam Collins. We are the people who do this show. It is a great privilege of mine to be joined today by the domestic cricket broadcaster of the year, an award handed down. Was it handed down by the ECB, Adam Collins? For it is you. You are it. You are he. You are that broadcaster.
Thank you, Jeff. Yeah, it's the Cricket Writers Club ECB annual awards that they do, which is nice. It's I sort of think that awards can be a bit of a lottery from time to time, especially in the media. But yeah, this meant a fair bit because I speak with the accent that I speak with and I'm living in the country that I live in, and those two things aren't necessarily compatible. but obviously what I'm saying is sensible enough that those making the decision saw fit to give me that gong. And it's, yeah, in the name of Christopher Martin Jenkins, which is pretty cool as well. I spent a lot of time reading books that CMJ had written last year when Norcross and I were making the Calling the Shots documentary, and of course learning about CMJ's story, which isn't a gazillion miles away from the sort of thing that you and I try and do, Jeff, that is sort of be journalists and be writers, but also broadcast and talk about the game. So, yeah, the fact that it's named after him is special. And, yeah, a lot of lovely comments yesterday from people around the cricketing world, but especially our Final Word community. So thank you for everyone that got in touch and said nice things. Yeah, it does mean a lot.
I just heard in the background down my headphones Winnie screaming down the hallway in a very enthusiastic style. Just before we started the show, Adam was off frame doing something else, and all I could hear was Rachel saying, no. And I just had to fill in the gaps as to what was happening in the hallway outside the room. So it's
she's just learnt that that what pinching is. And I don't think it's sort of meant in an aggressive way, but she knows it will get our attention, and she knows how to pull Rachel's hair as well. So that was the no. lucky she wasn't able to do that 12 months ago when, you know, like say, making the aforementioned Calling the Shots documentary. And it couldn't have happened if she had been crawling all over me. So anyway, so yes, a really nice start to the week yesterday with all of that. And onwards and upwards. And I suppose we were celebrating our own little milestone this morning, Jeff, when we ticked over 2 million people having listened to The Final Word since we moved to Bad Producer. So that's about 2 years since we went full throttle with weekly shows. It's kind of hard to remember what it was like before that, but we would do a few episodes here, a few episodes there. We'd often be commissioned by an organisation to work with them through a series or something like that.
Yep.
And eventually we're like, we actually want to make a real go of this, which means being a weekly podcast. And and that's when we found Jay, or when Jay agreed to take us on. I'd already worked with him a little bit as part of the Greatest Season That Was projects. But and everything changed for us then. And we've had the chance to build this show in all sorts of ways that anyone listening would probably be familiar with. But Jeff, the bit that stands out is the second million compared to the first million. I think we've added our second million in about 9 or 10 months or something like that.
Yeah, second comes right after first. But the second was a lot faster. So that's nice. That shows that things are going in the right direction. Yeah, the first season we did in 2015, because it was in England, it was proper BBC style, like the original Office, you know, 6-episode season. That's it. You're done. Yes. You're out. Quality only. And now we've moved into more of a sort of New Girl type arrangement with, you know, 28-episode seasons or whatever it is. And just keep them coming. But we've been having some fun doing it. So thank you to everyone who's in the 2 million. And I guess it's 3 next.
Yeah, it will be, and presumably three will come straight after two in quicker fashion again, which is cool. And I suppose now that we're making more daily shows, that's only natural. But yeah, the early days of The Final Word, I don't think we went to calling it The Final Word until season two. I think season one we were just known as the Ashes Cricket Podcast or something like that. It was something very generic when we were travelling around the UK, using BBC Studios, we had a bunch of great guests in that first season as well, where we would have like sort of a four-person conversation around the test match. Round table chat around the test match that had just been completed. So pretty different format now, but all part of the Final Word arc. I wonder how many eps we're up to. It must be in the order of 300 or something like that.
Shitloads
is the word, I think.
What was the White Line Wireless statistical category was? An MST, a metric shit ton. He's made an MST of runs in this Sheffield Shield season. I think it's something like 120 plus of the main weekly shows. 38 story times, I know that because the number's in the title. Yep. And then, I don't know, 100 and something other daily shows as well. So, yeah. Up towards that. But anyway, let's talk about cricket and not about cricket podcasts, because we've got a few things that we're talking about and not talking about today. The most important is the interview that we've got in the second half of the show, our interview about Brazilian cricket, which may not be a form of cricket that many of you are all of that au fait with, but we got put onto this tale by Alistair Townsend, who's one of our listeners. So we spoke with Roberta Moretti, who's the Brazilian women's captain, and Matt Featherstone, who's sort of got the ball rolling about 20 years ago with cricket in Brazil in its modern incarnation. And we've just finished recording a little look behind the curtain. We already know what they said. A really interesting chat with those two.
Yeah, and as soon as Alistair sent me a note saying you should do this story on The Final Word, I was all in because it's a great yarn. I mean, we touched on it last year when they gave the women professional contracts ahead of the men. It kind of came from nowhere and we didn't know much about this story, but it's totally worth it. There's so much good stuff going on in that specific pocket of Brazil where they've got cricket up and about, to the point where Matt Featherstone lives and works, cricket is bigger than football, which just seems remarkable when, I mean, we know what football means to Brazil, but they've been able to grow the game so quickly that cricket is leaving a real mark. So onwards and upwards for them. And yeah, stick around for that chat because it's a beauty.
Well, it's also about seeing more of the detail because when I travelled in Brazil, I met a lot of people who were really frustrated with the football thing, that, you know, that becomes the stereotype of their country, the same as, oh, did you know the cricket's like a religion in India? And you're like, yep, there are heaps of Indians who don't give a shit about cricket. Like, there are heaps who don't have time and there are ones who do, but they don't like it anyway. You know, the sort of generalisation that, yeah, the whole country's mad for it, everyone's playing football in their sleep. It is not the case. It is popular, but popular does not mean everybody. What we're not talking about on the show today, England and India in the T20s, because we're doing the daily show for that on YouTube. We sort of executive decisioned, I could just say decided, we decided not to put those as audio pods on the feed because we've done a lot of daily shows lately and weren't entirely sure what people would want, but if you want those, they're on YouTube if you want to find out the detail of what we reckon of what was going on in those games. And we'll get back to the Australian domestic stuff next week, because we're kind of mid Shield games at the moment and all the rest of it, so it's all ongoing.
This is also on YouTube, as was our weekly episode last week with Mark Butcher. It's kind of nice in a way just to come back to the 2 million thing for a sec. That it was the Mark Butcher episode that tipped us over the edge there, because that was a beautiful conversation. Listening back to it, Mark was so sort of open with us about his relationship with his dad and other parts of his life as well. So if you haven't heard that, go back in the feed or watch it on YouTube. I'm wearing the same jumper that I wore for the first T20 wrap-up a couple of days ago, which generated plenty of attention. Rach's mum knitted me this. It's an Aran jumper. It's huge. Oh. It's a classic winter English thing.
I gather it's to do with
I gather it's to do with the type of pattern through the middle. And another thing too is that these types of patterned jumpers, going back a long time, and I can't quite place when or where this was, but there was a time when these types of jumpers would all have different indentations on them, so that if you got lost at sea, I think it's if you got lost at sea, anyway, if you died an unpleasant death, they could work out who you are based on the pattern of the jumper that was made for you.
So it was like more comfortable dog tags.
Something like that.
Snug winter dog tags.
Yeah. So, but you can, yeah, if you're watching YouTube already, you'll know the kit I've got on. But those YouTube videos for the T20s have been going ever so nicely. Thank you for watching them. We're nearing a milestone on YouTube as well, which is crazy considering we started the channel like 2.5 months ago. But that's been an unexpected success of the pod so far this year.
Yeah, that's going to hit the million fairly shortly. But the Aaron, it made me think of Aaron Brindle actually first, who was used to be a England women's cricketer, who's always one whose name I enjoyed because an Aaron Brindle, it sounds like the sort of breed of a fancy horse that a really rich English person would own, you know. Oh, what kind is she? Oh, she's an Aaron Brindle. Oh, lovely. Look at her gait. It's a very elegant gait, you know. That's the kind of thing I can imagine.
She made a comeback, didn't she, Aaron Brindle? She came back for the first edition of the Kia Super League in 2016 and won the thing under the captaincy of Charlotte Edwards. That's another thing, by the way. Sorry to be indulgent, but the last thing about that award yesterday that I think was nice is that none of it would have happened without domestic women's cricket. Just want to lay a marker there. So I doubt I would have done much commentary in the England season through COVID and whatever else, but on the back of the Surrey Middlesex London Cup women's game, which was the first domestic game played in England after COVID, very biosecure conditions. There was no fans or anything like that, but that led towards working with Middlesex, which led towards working with Sky during the Bob Willis Trophy. And of course, I got to do some test match special as well for the Australia One Dayers and T20s. But it all comes back to that domestic women's scene over here, which barely existed as far as a product that people were watching on TV or listening to on radio until 2016. So I thought I'd mention that. So it all started with the women's game, which, you know, we've been so heavily invested in over, well, as long as we've covered cricket.
Yep. Very nicely observed. So let's get into some cricket, and we have to look at a test match win for Afghanistan against Zimbabwe. They didn't do so well in the first test of this series, but boy, did they come back strong in the second. In the UAE at the Sheikh Zayed Stadium, one of the top 10 stadiums named after a sheikh for my money, Afghanistan got up by 6 wickets. But it wasn't just that they won, it's that they batted really big in Test cricket. And that's, you know, it's always been the thing with Afghanistan is through their progression, through the limited overs formats, they've been a team with a lot of good spin bowlers before they had a lot of good batting, and they tended to struggle to chase targets and struggle to put up convincing scores, but they were a good fielding and bowling team. So to see them come out and go huge, 545 for 4, I mean, you know, pretty friendly batting conditions, but nonetheless, you still got to get them on the board. Afghanistan had one test century before this match. Ramat Shah had made the country's first ever test 100. They added 2 more in this game. Asghar Afghan got the second one. You know, he's the guy who we remember so well, who's, you know, was the captain, who's been around since the very start of this Afghanistan team's journey as a proper cricket side going up through the ICC rankings, 16, 17, 18 years ago that he was first getting involved. Got pushed out as captain just before the 2019 World Cup due to some politics. He's back in as captain now. He made 164. Hashmatullah Shahidi made an even 200, and at the point that they declared. So within their first 3 test centuries, they've got a test double century. No other country's done it faster than that. The West Indies did the same. Their third test 100 was a double. It took England 38 test 100s before they got to a double ton. So, you know, they've done something really remarkable.
Yeah, and I love the response to Hashmatullah's double 100. It obviously meant so much to him, having batted all the way through 160 overs. And then Ibrahim Zadran, who came ever so close to getting a bannerman for himself, or getting the bannerman, I should say. And we'll come to that later in the ep, actually. But he made 72 as a 19-year-old. Yeah. So someone to watch sort of as we observe the Afghanistan team in years to come. So it's not just that group that brought them. And this was a little bit of the island story for a while. Like they reached test status with the golden generation who'd been there largely since 2005 and gone all the way through until 2018 when they played that first test match. But there was a question about what was coming through, and that's the next challenge for Irish cricket. The encouraging thing here for Afghanistan is that Ibrahim Zadran is reflective of the fact that there is a generation coming straight through beneath the experienced players who've been there through the associate days, and they need that in order to keep regenerating and remaining sustainable as a competitive team into the future.
Yep, I liked the way the Asghar Afghan innings came about. It was that sort of block, block, bash style. Yes. Where he got to 50 and then immediately hit 6-4-4. Then he blocked for a while. Then he took 16 off and over from Victor Nyouchi to raise his century. And they were all those big leg side clouts. At Abu Dhabi, it was very reminiscent of Misbah Al-Haq in 2014. I was watching watching the 100 come up live, and yeah, that it just kept bringing back Misbah taking down Steve Smith when he made that 100 off 56 balls. But you know, that was exciting to see. And then the way they just batted long into the next day, and then it was poor old Rashid Khan, who you know, who's had some injuries, some finger injuries and whatnot, bowled nearly 100 overs in the Test match and had to back it up because they decided to enforce the follow-on. Asghar Afghan, the captain, was like, yeah, no worries. We've bowled out Zimbabwe for 287. We picked three bowlers, basically. Rashid Khan's bowled 36 and a half overs, taken 4 for 138, conceding nearly half the runs. Yeah, let's enforce the follow-on. So they did. Got him 7 down for 142, and then there's a partnership of 187, and he just had to keep bowling and keep bowling.
Yeah, I can see what they were thinking in terms of having racked up that huge score and having such an imposing first innings lead. Why not sort of go for the kill? But yeah, the way the team was balanced, it meant that there was always going to be so much work on the shoulders of Rashid Khan. It wasn't lost upon many people that he bowls, I think, is it 88 overs or 86 overs in the IPL if he plays every game and bowls the full allotment, and bowled 99 here in a game, 99, just under 100, and we'll come to the statistical relevance of that in a tick. But yeah, in that follow-on, Zimbabwe, quite outstanding. Sean Williams, the skipper, made a century in the first test and an unbeaten 151 in the second. A guy who made his international debut all the way back in 2005, and we saw how good he was at the 2015 World Cup, Jeff, and at different times he's been in the team and then out of the team for long stretches. He's played county cricket as well, but now very much leading the Zimbabwean team. And to victory in the first test, not so much here, but there was nothing around him. It felt like that they were on track for a huge thumping innings defeat, and then there was the stand that changed everything.
Yeah, Donald Turupano, a bowler, you know, let's make no bones about it. Comes in and just bats long with Williams, ended up making 95, got out just short of 100, but that actually took them to a reasonable lead. It got them 107 in front, and you would not be shocked at all to see, you know, Afghanistan, a team that's played, what, five or six entire existence. You wouldn't be shocked to see a team like that fall over like Ireland did against England at Lord's at the end of that Test match. You know, you wouldn't be shocked to see them not be able to chase a three-figure score in the fourth innings with a bit of pressure on. But that was really the best sign out of the match, to my eye, was that they didn't have a problem. They closed it out. They lost a wicket early, and that still didn't rattle them. You know, got most of the way there and then lost three wickets right when they were about to get over the line. So it wasn't like they were four down and heading into trouble. It was, you know, the last three were within 10 runs of the target, and they weren't going to fall short at that point.
Yeah, and had to hold their nerve as well. Remember, in the second innings, 148.5 overs they sent down. Rashid Khan, 62.5 of those, 17 maiden, 7 for 137, worth repeating. That, you know, if you're chasing 108 in those circumstances, and that's the beauty of Test cricket, isn't it? You could have, they make 545 the first time around, but, you know, having to return to get 108, having spent, I don't know how many overs they bowled for in the first inning. I think it was about 90. So they spent pretty much 2.5, 3 days in the field, and they're left with that nagging total in the penultimate and final session of the Test match. So, and I love the fact that it was Ramat Shah there who held it together, an unbeaten 58, to get them through to a 1-1 result in the series. And I've got to say, Jeff, I mean, there was obviously a lot of attention on this Test as it was reaching its conclusion, a lot of attention during that incredible partnership in Zimbabwe's second innings. And the fact that it was on live television here and we had that conversation a couple of weeks ago meant that so many people were drawn to it. I'm glad that now a lot of people seem to have taken up the cause of why isn't there an organised structure for Test cricket for teams outside of the World Test Championship. I mean, 9 teams sit inside of that, which means Zimbabwe, Afghanistan and Ireland, the 3 full member nations of the ICC, so Test best playing nations who currently aren't part of that structure, so ad hoc test matches is as good as they can kind of hope for. Well, okay, why don't we add Nepal? Why don't we add Holland? Why don't we add Scotland and have a second division of six teams? I saw Andrew Nixon, the great campaigner for associate cricket and journalist, talking about this on social media, and it makes loads of sense to me. They don't need to play as much test cricket as the other first division of nine to make it worthwhile. They just need a structure, and if they do, it'll make days like this even more important.
Well, I mean, literally the only reason that something like that wouldn't happen and isn't happening is because of the money that it costs those countries to stage test matches, and because they don't have that money to spare, they're not allocated that. The sort of test cricket fund from the ICC doesn't exist, and you know, we've talked about it a million times, but the allocation of revenue between the handful of big countries that take most of it and everybody else who gets the rest means that it's impossible practically to stage those. But yeah, that seems like a really obvious thing that could and should be happening, where you could be helping develop test cricketers. You know, you get better at test cricket by playing it, and teams get more able to cope with it by doing it. And, you know, Rashid Khan will be sore after 99 overs, but the next time he goes out to play in a test match, he'll have the confidence of having that performance under his belt.
Yeah, that's right. And it's just all about, I mean, they're still going to play test cricket, but it's that ad hoc nature of it, which means that it doesn't quite feel... It doesn't feel as, I mean, meaningful is the wrong word. It still feels meaningful. But if it had a structure around it, even if one of those top nine spots in the WTC was up for grabs, if there was some promotion relegation, you know, that, I don't think it's impossible to find a structure where this can work. And we've talked about two divisions of test cricket before. This isn't about two divisions where there's sort of some secondary status. It's more just like allowing these countries to play each other with greater regularity, and it'll have far more riding on it, which should mean, as you say, the standard rises over time rather than, I mean, you say Afghanistan might have played five test matches. Well, how many have Zimbabwe played in the last 10 years? Now, sure, a lot of that can be attributed to their internal governance and the cliff they went off financially. But still, I mean, you know, that is a problem, and they are a full member nation of the ICC. So speaking of the 99.2 overs that Rashid Khan bowled, Jeff, I thought you would like to know that it is the most overs bowled in a test match since Murali bowled 113.5 against Zimbabwe back in 1998, and the most ever, 129, that's six ball overs. It was Sonny Ramadan at Edgbaston against England in 1957, which is the test match that we've talked about a few times on this feed, both in story time but also in calling the shots, because that was the first ever test match broadcast on what was then known for the first time as Test Match Special. So if you want to learn more about that test, you can do so deeper in the feed. But yeah, it gives it some context. This was a massive, mighty shift from Rashid Khan and collecting match figures of 11 for a squillion over nearly 100 overs.
11 for 275 after his 99.2 overs. So yeah, the team bowled 91 in the first innings, 149 in the second. It's like those old sort of follow-ons when Bradman was captain, you know, and he'd bowl Ray Lindwell into the ground over 120 overs and then pop them in and make them follow on. But they used to have the rest day back then, so that made it slightly different. Anyway, for all of those overs, I think we should give Rashid Khan the coveted Cbus Super Performer of the Week. I know that he's as a man who thinks about his future, the most overs bowled in the 21st century. Know when to declare and retire the way you want. That is the tagline, and he may be considering retirement from Test cricket after that workload. But if he is, he could visit cbussuper.com.au/thefinalword.
I like it. Maybe he can visit the 21st Century Nightclub if it's still there down in Frankston with the revolving dance floor. Did you ever go there when you were a teenager at university? Did it ever take you in, Jeff?
I didn't make it that far. I took the train down to Frankston a few times, so that was a fairly harrowing experience on occasion. But
that was quite the spot. I did some campaigning down there in the 2004 election, I think it was, and we ended up
on the
21st
revolving
century
dance floor
a number of times on the revolving dance floor. No regrets.
Well, look, maybe you should have regrets about that. Who knows? That is the web address for you to go to if you want to find out about your superannuation. Who's saving money? Channel 7, they're trying to save money. They're trying to squirrel some away on the deal they agreed to with Cricket Australia. And curiously, as it links to what we've just talked about, the key piece in the negotiations, the Maltese Falcon that they're all trying to get their hands on, is a test match against Afghanistan. Now, how likely would this have been, say, 12 months ago?
Yeah, this is a really interesting subplot to the stoush between CA and Seven. And yes, we've talked about it quite a bit on the show in the last 9 months, and probably will for the next 9 months as well, given the attitude that Seven have been taking towards this in recent days. It's in the federal court this week. So an independent arbitrator came in and said, independent arbiter might be the right word, not arbitrator, came in and said that Seven were entitled to a $5.3 million discount on their fee of 82 mil. Now, the irony here, of course, is that they were originally offered 15 mil by Cricket Australia and said, you can stick that up your ass, we're going to court. And they've come back getting just over a third of that. Seven, by the way, they want a discount of 70 million out of 82. They want a fair bit more than the 5.3.
Wait, that, what?
That's what their original claim, according to reports, the original claim they were after, they wanted, and this, of course, is going to be taken out of the payments going forward. So they resolved the issue late last year. They did pay what they were meant to pay and so on. But whatever the discount they eventually get will be taken off their fees for next year. So if I've read this correctly, that they're after 70 and at the moment the clock's at 5.3. But where Afghanistan comes in, because that test was postponed last summer and it was meant to be part of the offering, that's now worth $3 million to Cricket Australia. So according to what went down late last week, last Friday, if that test match doesn't go ahead, then Seven get three extra mil as part of their discount for what happened during the COVID summer of 2021. So
the COVID summer of 1920. Yes, that's right. The heady days after the war, things were looking up, but then COVID struck.
It was a summer we were talking about on Storytime just last week with Roy Park, wasn't it? Anyway, yeah, so where this got to was that, well, it's in federal court and the stoush continues, as I mentioned off the top, but this Afghanistan test kind of slipped us by because it has been announced by Cricket Afghanistan. In December last year, they, on their own terms, said they were going to come to Australia for a test match before the Ashes of this coming summer. I missed that. You missed that. I think everybody missed that. But I assume
the CA hasn't confirmed it. So,
well, no, but they essentially have. The Afghanistan administrators have said this is the agreement they've arrived at, and I understand it to be the case that this is going ahead. So,
but it hasn't been announced by Cricket Australia.
No, but nor has the Ashes. So it's these things get announced in the fullness of time in the middle of a year. But the point here is that this test is going ahead. But if it weren't to, that's worth $3 mil to Channel 7 in the current, not agreement, because they're not accepting the view of the arbiter, but it goes on. So, the boss of Channel 7, James Warburton, called Cricket Australia bumbling and stumbling and called the scheduling last year stupid. And Jeff, just to recap on what they mean by that, it's to do with the fact that there was no test cricket last November, and the argument they're advancing is that the one day is coming first in that sort of coveted spot at the start of the summer is enough to justify this whole brouhaha. That if it had have been test cricket there at the start of the summer against India, that would have been something they would have been satisfied with. It's principally due to the order of international cricket last year, but as we know, that kind of relates to a whole bunch of other stuff to do with quarantine and where the teams were preparing and where they could hub, and there was a lot going on.
What we know is that Channel 7 came up with about 16 different reasons as to why they should get a discount, and as each of those reasons became no longer current, they moved on to another reason. And so the reasons that they eventually settled on were there should have been test cricket earlier and there wasn't, and the one dayers came first and that wasn't fair because they were on pay TV, and also that there weren't enough Australian national players in the Big Bash.
Yes.
There have never been Australian national players in the Big Bash. They don't play in the Big Bash because they're always playing something else, like the one dayers that are not in November but are later in the summer, where Channel 7 apparently wanted them to be. So those were their contradictory positions. But I think the way it worked out was that the only tangible thing they could point to that they had actually lost was the Afghanistan test match. Everything else went ahead. All of the other fixtures were played. They didn't miss out on anything else. They missed out on a test match, which, you know, had it been held in Perth as was planned, could have been over in 2 days and probably wouldn't have been a huge revenue spinner for the network that had it on, you know, as they filled in the next 3 days with repeats of like Love Island or whatever it is that they do. So that was the position that they were in, where it's not that they actually care about that test match, that is my interpretation. It's that that was something that they could actually legitimately make a complaint about. And so, yeah, the arbitration said, okay, well, if that doesn't happen, then you can have some more money back. But it is pretty funny that the amount they've been given is a third of the amount that they refused to accept as not being enough, given that nothing really had actually changed for them.
Yeah, and people who follow the paper trail and follow this side of it closer than us have reported and have declared that Seven want out of this big time. Like, you know, it's an Ashes summer, sure, but even though the ratings were great, and there's this sort of contradiction as well, that we were getting press releases from Channel 7 throughout the course of the summer saying, this record broken, that record broken, extraordinary audiences watching the India-Australia series. And fair enough, too, because it was a tremendous series. I mean, people are going to watch that, as
all
they
of
will
their
the
ads,
Ashes.
Their ads for the Big Bash that said, literally said, all of the stars are coming to Australia at the same time as they were launching a court action saying there were not enough stars coming to Australia. Consistency of messaging hasn't been their strong point through this.
Yeah, so I suppose the scenario which could play out is that another free-to-air provider might be required to catch the ball in time for the Ashes. So we'll keep a watch on that, and we might get someone who's followed it closer than us, the court proceedings, to update us on the show next week. By the way, Jeff, I'm not sure if you spotted the story.
Can we buy him?
Yeah,
can we buy it out? Do a
crowdfunder. I wonder what price they would put on it.
Be a fire sale.
It isn't completely outside the realms of possibility that it'll be done by it'll be done in a different way in the next right cycle. We see the BCCI make their own product. Could we rule out Cricket Australia doing something similar? They've made a lot of content for streaming services in the last couple of years. I mean, they've made a documentary for Amazon only last year. But anyway, I digress. There was another story I thought I'd just quickly lay a marker for that we need to talk about in greater depth. Indian investors reportedly wanting to buy into BBL clubs, which is essentially privatising the Big Bash League. Now, there's 10 years of history here, and Dan Bredig wrote a marvellous piece in the Cricket Monthly a couple of years ago explaining why they avoided private investment at the start of all this and why it ended up being a great masterstroke of the state associations and Cricket Australia holding onto their asset. I mean, as anyone who knows anything about government would say, you can only sell an asset once. You can't flog it time and time again. There's a short-term, you know, yield from it. Yeah. Where this is a bit more complicated, I suppose, is that the ACA, so the Players Union, are quite interested in private investment because they see it as potentially a new revenue stream for grassroots cricket. So there's a bit to run on this. I don't want to sort of take a hard and firm position, but I think it's the sort of thing that we should keep a close eye on at final week headquarters
in
weeks
to come.
Doesn't
the money they make off it go into grassroots cricket as it is? Like, isn't that the point?
Well, I think the argument would be is they can make more, right? If you're a private investor, you can make more. So I saw some back and forth on social media yesterday that this feeds into the argument that the Big Bash is somehow fundamentally broken. And that is contested territory because it rates well. You know, as we talked about before, there's a lot of players come in from overseas and play in it. This year, after the test matches finished, a lot of international Australian players, contrary to what Seven were pointing to, played as well. So it isn't an easy argument to advance that the whole thing's cooked. But I also understand why they might want to try and make more money out of it. But like I say, you can only sell something once. So that might be, it'll be interesting to see how the new chief executive of Cricket Australia, whoever that ends up being, addresses this issue, because James Sutherland, when he was running the show, was very much against that. That's where they arrived at. And yeah, that's all documented in Bredig's piece, which is worth a read if you're interested in that kind of thing.
Indeed. South Africa and India, the women's series that's going on in India at the moment, the South Africans bounced back and won the thing. It was 1-1 last time we talked. They're missing Danai van der Kerk, their fearless leader. They're missing Chloe Tryon, their biggest hitter in the game. And they've racked up a couple of big run chases back-to-back, one on Duckworth Lewis and then a bigger one that didn't involve any rain assistance whatsoever, ran down 266 that India set them without any problems at all, really. It's been a pretty remarkable showing.
What a fantastic story this is. South African cricket, women's cricket's on the rise. I mean, yes, interest declared. I've been following them very closely and, you know, a huge fan of their story for a long period of time. But under Laura Woolvart, they've been able to win the third and fourth match of the series. In the third, as you say, it was affected by Duckworth Lewis. But Lizelle Lee, 132 not out off 131 balls, if you don't mind. She jumps to number one in the ODI batter rankings, overtaking Tammy Beaumont, who went up to number one after the New Zealand series. So that was the third one day, which I should add, Mithali Raj passed 10,000 international runs for India, just the second woman to reach that milestone, joining Charlotte Edwards, who finished with 10,273 runs in 316 international innings. Well, Mithali's only played 291 innings for her 10,000 and change, 10 test matches, 213 one-day internationals and 89 T20s. So, and then in the fourth one day, she went beyond 7,000 one-day runs, and she's the first woman to achieve that at a remarkable average of 50.5, seven centuries and an additional 54 scores over 50. So at age 38, she's not done yet. So that's the Indian story, I suppose, all around Mithali Raj. But for South Africa, in that fourth one day, India rack up 266. Poonam Raut made an unbeaten century, which was their main contributor. Harmanpreet Kaur made 54, Mithali Raj 45. But then South Africa go and chase it down fearlessly. They won with eight balls to spare, and it was so consistent. They win by seven wickets. Lizelle Lee, 69. Laura Woolvart, 53. Laura Goodall, 59 not out, her highest score in international cricket. Mignon Dupriya, 61. And Marizanne Kapp finished the job with an unbeaten 22. So a true team effort, and the equal fifth biggest chase in women's one-day internationals, the biggest successful chase for South Africa. And, I mean, they're talking a big game, Jeff. After that game, they're like, we're going to win this 4-1, and then we're going to go and win the World Cup. I mean, fair enough. I mean, they've got a very strong bowling lineup with Shabbir Mizamal picked up her 150th one-day wicket in the third game, I think it was. Ayabonga Kaka has got some serious pace. Marizanne Kapp, they bring back Danae van Niekerk. They bring back Chloe Tryon. There is definitely something about this South African team. They came so close to making the T20 World Cup final 12 months ago. And, yeah, they're building so well to win away against India. Yeah, no mean feat.
And particularly, I think, with Woolvart at the helm, does that mean we can assume that she's decided to go with cricket? Because, you know, there's been this back and forth about whether she'll go and become a doctor and whether she'll keep being a cricketer, but she's continued being a cricketer for the time being. And like watching her in the Big Bash over, you know, late last year, it's not like she came out and made hundreds every time she came out, but there's just something in the way that some batters play where you know that they're a level above the players around them. And she genuinely is. Like she's still got so much upside that she can get a whole lot better, but she's got something in terms of timing and placement that most players will never have, and that exceptionalism, that distance above the next best, is something that, like, I just reckon that the next 5 or 10 years could see her do incredible things if she's able to really commit to it.
Yeah, and the fact that she's got sort of big game experience. I mean, there's that World T20 campaign last year, but you go back to the 50 over World Cup. I mean, it feels like a long time ago, 2017, where
it was a long
we
time
collectively, ago. we collectively fell in love with that cover drive of hers that she played so well through the course of that tournament. She was 17 then, I reckon, maybe even 16. Mm. So she's still very much in the early stages of her international journey. Actually, she might have been 18 then, because I think that's when the question about medical school first bobbed up. And then when we had her in England again the year after, playing in the bilateral series, it was touch and go. And I suppose, as you say, if she's still playing and leading her country, it would seem that cricket's won out for the time being. So great story that they've been able to win over there. They've got one more one day, which is on Wednesday, then three T20s after that. I would say that to the extent to which we were critical of New Zealand last week on the show and worried that they perhaps won't be competitive in a home World Cup, if you were grouping the teams together, I think that South Africa are going to be just that next level down beneath Australia, England, and maybe India possibly when we sort of frame up who might win the comp next year, which is great.
Yep. And the other little bit of news in women's cricket was that Sarah Taylor has joined the Sussex men's team as the wicket-keeping coach. It was good to see a clip on the British News, I can't remember which channel it was, when they announced this and they put up file footage of Kate Cross doing warm-ups instead of Sarah Taylor, kicking a football around. So when you want to announce Sarah Taylor being a cricketer, definitely get a different player kicking your football. That's how you do it. That's how file footage works. Well done.
Yeah. Hello to Kate Cross, if you're listening, former guest of the final word. And, yeah, great news for Sarah Taylor. I interviewed her might have been 13, 14 months ago. We did a big photo shoot down at Sussex there when she'd finished as an international and she was doing, for the magazine, I mean.
Just not you and Sarah. Just did a big photo shoot.
Photos of Sarah.
I imagined the two of you being in there, like some sort of, I don't know, like crushed velvet divan and like, you know, draped artistically, got some grapes, you know, layered over the appropriate areas.
There were some artistic sort of shots taken, but yeah. Anyway, it was for the Women's Cricket Zone magazine, and which came out this week too, I should say, with some lovely writing from Vish and so on. But no, at that point in time, Sarah was sort of like obviously wanting to remain involved in the game, but didn't really know where exactly. And I'm glad that a year on that she's found her place. And I mean, why wouldn't you want Sarah Taylor seeing the next generation or aiding the next generation of wicketkeepers at your club? I mean, she's the best I've seen. The best I've seen in women's cricket. It's hard to necessarily make judgments next to the men because it's a very different job when you're standing up to seamers all day long. But glad to see she's been retained by the game.
Yep, indeed. I think that brings us to our own game. Would you like to play a game, Adam?
I would, Jeff.
Excellent. Let's play a game. It is called Nerd Pledge. Nerd Pledge. The game we play with people on our Patreon page. They support the show by sending us an amount of currency. Not a normal amount, not a round number, but a different number. A number that has some relationship to cricket. And we have to work out what the number means. Fittingly, on our Brazilian cricket show, our first Nerd Pledger is a friend of the show, Andrew Gilbertson, also known as Andrew Gilbertson, the creative left-footed midfielder who has done such sterling work just behind the centre circle. The number that he sent in was, in fact, a round number. So I lied about that part because, you know, it could be a round number and a Nerd Pledge number. It's $4, so it's 400. But Andrew specifically sent us a message to say that it is a Nerd Pledge number. It means something. Now, obviously, Adam, 400 in cricket means something, pretty obvious.
Yeah, it does. I mean, if we're, you know, looking at scores, there's Lara. Mm-hmm. In recent times, we've been looking at 400 in the context of Lyon v. Ashwin. I'd be surprised if it were any of those three, though. I think Andy Gilbertson, who we've corresponded with a fair bit through Nerd Pledge, I reckon he'll be going to a slightly deeper level.
Okay. I didn't mind the 400 because at the time he sent it, the race to 400 was on. Ashwin and Lyon were still competing for 400. So that could be one. You know, Brian Lara breaking the world record for the second time for the highest test score is another one. We've spoken about that on the show before, about what an admirably petty individual Brian Lara was, that he set 375. That was the record for 10 years. Matthew Hayden broke it, and within 6 months, Lara had taken it back again. That's my world record.
With the 400 being the slowest of the four, if I recall correctly, or something like that. Well, he wanted that record.
Yeah, you'd be fairly tired by that point. I wish he'd gone on to 420, personally. it would have been much more entertaining. But I was thinking, okay, 400, if it's something less obvious than Lara's 400, could it be someone we were just talking about, Dane van Niekerk, who took four wickets for none in a tournament we were just talking about, the 2017 Women's World Cup. It is the only such haul in tests or one days for men or women where a player has taken four wickets for no runs. That has not happened in any other format. In men's cricket, of any international format, the best is Richie Beno took three for none in Delhi in a test match. Women's ODIs, there are a couple of three for nones. One of them is Aaron Brendle, the very expensive kind of horse. And the other, which I particularly liked, well, her name's Olivia, but she's in the record books as O.J. Magno, last name spelled M-A-G-N-O. So if you swap the G and the N, she becomes a kind of juice. remember like when you were growing up, all of those Prima Poppers would be orange and mango juice? I don't know why that was absolutely the combo, but they were mad for orange and mango.
Oh, I still now, when I see orange and mango in the supermarket, I think about happy days at my grandparents' house as a little boy. So you're absolutely right there.
So those are the only three for nones in women's ODIs. Dane's got the only four for none. Although a place that you will find some three for nones or better is in women's T20 International, since they opened up the stats to all competing countries about a year and a bit, no, 2 years ago.
2 years ago, yeah.
So there have been 10 occasions in women's T20s where someone's taken 3 for none or more. That includes a 5 for none for Tanzania against Mali and a 6 for none for Nepal against the Maldives. But one of the players who took 3 for none is Nicole Monteiro of Brazil.
Hey.
Who took it against Chile in 2019 in Lima, the birthplace of former England captain Freddie Brown. So, Andrew Gilbertson, there is a very tenuous link to Brazilian cricket, which we will talk about at more length very shortly.
Oh, thanks, Jeff. That's good. I like all of that. I would just note that Joe Root took a 2 for none, and at one stage in the third test match against India, at one stage he had 3 for none, and that sent statisticians into hysterics. So, like, this is going to happen. He's going to finish with 3 for none alongside Richie Beno, but he kept bowling and finished with 5 for 8. So looking forward to finding out from Andrew what that is. Next up, we have Jono Halen, who's been contributing to the show in more ways than one of late. You can listen to Storytime for more on that.
Yes.
Jono has sent through 247.
Yep, 247, and Jono has been providing us with updates on the career of Jodie Hicks, which is very appreciated. So the author of Hicks Watch, he sent you a clue, Adam, as well, quite a detailed clue. A series-specific number, says Jono, an admirable series for a player still in his first year as a test cricketer against a team on a streak. As a 16-year-old, I loved watching this player take on Australia at their best. While he had a turbulent tour, his good moments were enjoyable as they were all under pressure. Adam may envy this man as he had a great view of a test match hat-trick. From his efforts in cricket post-career, his efforts in the community are to be commended as he continues fighting the good fight politically. What have you got?
Yes, he ends by saying, dare I say, he's one of us. Insert Sam Seaborn handwriting, the West Wing final word crossover.
That's a joke going, that I don't get again. That you do.
No, that's fine. Look, what I first thought of was, I went the politically progressive route, and who fits into that category? I kind of thought Mark Ramprakash, on the basis that he made his debut in 1991 against a team on a streak, that being the West Indies, having not lost a series since 1981 or something like that. And then he came to Australia in the summer of 1990-91. I mean, none of it quite works, but, you know, the point here is that I thought that might have been where he was going, but, yeah, none of the numbers quite tallied, and I had to look further afield. I also thought, because he was in the team with Darren Goff when Goff took his hat-trick in Australia in 1999, the non-striker was Shane Warne for that hat-trick, amusingly enough. But no, we were the wrong country, and Jeff, you got me back on track. You're like, it must be something to do with the streak that Australia were on leading into, well, Calcutta 2001, a test match that finished on this day, maybe it was yesterday, 20 years ago, 20 years ago this week, yeah. So, but that streak got to 16. And the West Indies, bless them, they ran headfirst into that in the summer of 2001 when they were doomed from the get-go, really. They arrived and got pumped at the Gabba, as teams often do, but this was particularly brutal. And then they went to Perth for the second test match. They had to bat first, and an hour into the first morning, they were 5 for 22. Glenn McGrath taking a hat-trick in the ninth over of the test match, they went from 2 for 19 to 4 for 19. Now, down the other end, who was watching that hat-trick, the non-striker, was a man by the name of Wavell Hines, who my brother always liked growing up. My brother would always like Wavell. And he made it to a half century in those very trying circumstances that Jono Halen's referring to, 50 from 87 balls after walking in at number 3. It didn't make a difference in the end. They get pumped. They lose the series 5-0. But he made 247, our Nerd Pledge number, at 31 for the tour. He made another half century in the final test. He made 70 and 46 at the SCG. All up, Wavell Hines played in 45 test matches between 2000 and 2005. His career finished in Australia in that tour that they played 5 years on. He made 5 test centuries, 5 one-day international centuries as well. But the political hook here is that since 2012, Wavell Hines was the boss of the West Indies Players Union. So that's the political fellow traveller reference that he was making there. And in terms of being a good human more generally, he's also heavily committed now in the Paralympics movement. He's the chief de mission for Jamaica for the 2024 edition of the Paralympic Games. So Wavell Hines, I remember him being a gutsy player as well, who had a nice strong swinging arc across as a left-hander, could hit through the line. line beautifully. A couple of those contributions in 2000, 2001 were noteworthy on a very tough tour where he made 247 runs and still doing good things for the community and for sport. Thank you, John O'Halen.
Yeah, that sounds like a very convincing answer. I think he's also involved in politics in Jamaica now. I reckon he's stood for election. I'm not sure at what sort of level, if it's a kind of local level or a more national level, or indeed how deep the levels go in Jamaican politics. It's not a very big place. That is something I will admit to knowing nothing about, but I do remember seeing something about him running for election, maybe not that long ago even. Anyway, that's a vague thought, but I think he is involved politically, so that sounds convincing. Right, one more number for today from Sukrit Munjal, $5.71. The little clue, the little couplet reads... Think India while solving this riddle. Fastest to 50, still ridiculed a lot. I have something the God never got. Dun, dun, dun. Okay, fastest to 50. Fastest to 50 what? Is it fastest to 50 test wickets? Because that was Ravichandran Ashwin in 9 test matches. Fastest test 50 scored for India was by Kapil Dev, but neither of those were players that have been ridiculed, really. Someone who was ridiculed, Adam, and probably still is, Ajit Agarkar, who we've talked about his streak of ducks in test cricket before. You know, when you work in this kind of area like we do and you get sent random stuff from like PR agencies and so on, I got an email that was for sign up for an online maths course with Ajit Agarkar. And I was like, "What is the lesson? Like, what's naught plus naught plus naught plus naught plus naught plus naught?" But I decided not to put that on the internet. But here we are. I've just said it in the podcast. So the streak of ducks actually started as early as his second career test match, unfortunately for him. But the first innings, he batted really nicely for an hour and a half, made 19, put on a partnership of 46, you know, good number eight test sort of stuff. And then after that, the ducks began 5 in a row, golden duck, golden duck, golden duck, golden duck, second ball duck, played a few tests against other teams, and then a year and a half later in Mumbai, faced Australia again and made a pair to make it 7 in a row against Australia.
Yeah, I remember one of those ducks well. It was the second innings at Melbourne, so that would have been that week we keep coming back to on Storytime, isn't it? That final week of 1999 where I reckon he faced 20 balls and the pressure was building and the whole MCG was all over him, and then he holed out to Mark Waugh bowling part-time off spin. So that was a memorable one. And then, yeah, the Mumbai pair to finish it off. And I don't think he played in Calcutta or Chennai. I think that was his last test match. Well, obviously, he came back
Sourav
and
Ganguly was taking the new ball in Calcutta.
Right, right. Yes, yes. So, yeah. But it continued. Like you say, he still had a career against Australia and won a test match for them in 03, 04. But I'm sure you'll tell us about that in a sec.
Indeed. Sourav Ganguly got Michael Slater out for 46 in Calcutta, I reckon. I think you'll find. My brain just told me
take
that.
Your word
I'm going to believe it's true. Yeah, bowling with the new ball, a little bit of outswing. So anyway, in between the 5 ducks and the 2 ducks, in between those times, in December 2000, he just so happened to stroll out and make India's fastest ever one-day half century. To this day, it remains India's fastest ever one-day half century, which is remarkable in the T20 era. So off 21 balls against a decent Zimbabwe side, that good early 2000s Zim side at Rajkot, he made 67 from 25 balls in the end, 4 sixes, 7 fours. And then in July 2002, he got what the God never got, what Sachin Tendulkar never got, which was a test century at Lord's. Made 109 not out in the fourth innings, batting for a draw. Didn't quite seal the match out, but did a good job. And a postscript to that is that later the same year, after making the test 100, he made 95 in a one-day game against the Windies. He got promoted to first drop. He came in at the fall of the first wicket. Sourav Ganguly said, why not? He's seeing him well. So he came in, he smashed 95 off 101 balls, set them up a nice target, and then the West Indies were chasing it. Ramanaresh Sawan made 80-odd, and Ajit Agarkar was bowling the final over of the match and conceded a boundary from the last delivery of the match when they had three to defend, and they lost the game. So poor old Ajit, he missed out on the 100 and didn't quite get to close out the game.
I wonder whether he was, just to come back to that one day international, he might have been in that really interesting category of players who got promoted to pinch hit in that era. So sort of around the late 90s, we often think about Shane Warne, I should say, in the quarterfinal of the 96 World Cup. Brendan Julian. I mean, Jason Gillespie was doing it in South Africa in 1997. I was talking to Jared Kimber about this the other day, the sorts of things that Jared and I talk about, sad as it is. But yeah, maybe Ajit Ogurka was a pinch hitter, but then he went on to have a strike rate of less than 100, which is, I suppose, unusual given the job, but he still made 95. What a day.
At the time, I mean, he was pretty much a runner ball. He was 95 off 101. So he was close enough to a runner ball. And at the time, that was fast. Like, that was the match reports say that he blazed a 95 and so on. Like, they're really impressed. You know, it wasn't 95 off 138 or whatever. What was some of the highlights from one of those early 90s games with Booney bringing up, or Jeff Marsh bringing
Jeff
up 50
Marsh.
Off 110 balls?
Yeah, yeah.
Saluting the crowd. It's taking the shine off it.
Yeah, that one day international was on our on one of the subscription services over here until recently, and I alerted Nick Tuvey, a friend of the show, to the fact that it's on YouTube, and he live tweeted the entire game the other day, which was the 91-92 final at Sydney, one day final against India. But yes, Jeff Marsh getting a standing ovation for a half century and 110 balls, which gives you a bit of a sense of what one day cricket was like in the 90s.
I think Ravi Shastri did the same in the reply. He was opening in the reply. I reckon it was 50 off about 100. Anyway, all of this is to say, why was Sukrit Munjal's nerd pledge number $5.71 when wanting to link it to Ajit Ogurka? That is the total number of career test runs that Ogurka scored in his 26 test matches at an average of 16.79, which is the 10th lowest test average for a batsman to have made a test century.
Ah, lovely.
And that is your number, Sukrit Munjal. Thank you all for your Nerd Pledge numbers. If you want to play the game, very easy. Go to patreon.com/thefinalword. Make an account. Put the number in. We'll see the number. We'll put it on the list. We'll do it on the show. Couldn't be easier. And you will help us keep making the show week to week.
Beautifully done, Jeff. Okay, time for us to take a break to grab a cup of tea, maybe, if that's what you like doing before listening to an interview, which we have coming up with the Brazilian national captain, Roberto Moretti, and the head of Cricket Brazil, Matt Featherston.
Hi, my name's Kate Cross, and you're listening to The Final Word with Adam and Jeff.
Jeff, it's that time again to talk about a little satellite device that's close to both of our hearts. It's called the Zolio. How's that?
It's the Zolio. Whoa, whoa. It is. It's literally close to my heart. I'm holding it right now, the Zolio, in my hand. You'd be able to see that on a video, but not on a podcast. That's how the audio medium works. You know me, Adam. Pretty adventurous guy. Love to get out in the great outdoors. You know, I love some trekking, some hiking.
The one time I've sent you off on a hike, this is probably a story worth telling. So after the sandpaper test came to its natural conclusion, Australia losing in 4 days, it meant that we had this day that we didn't expect to have, the fifth day, because the test didn't feel like it was going to finish in 4 days, and then of course it did, and it was a fairly rugged couple of days for us professionally. We were doing interviews around the clock, writing articles for seemingly every publication around the world. But our colleague, or I suppose on that tour, my colleague for radio was Adam Voges, who was working with us. And of course, he didn't have any commitments on day five. He was just, you know, hanging around waiting for the fourth test match to start. So at the bar, he said something to us like, oh, I want to go and climb at Table Mountain tomorrow. And you'd hinted to me at some point along the week, you said, I wouldn't mind trying to possibly maybe climb Table Mountain, but I might get a cable car up there. And I'm like, no, you should do it. Rach and I have done it. I've done it before.
I wanted to get on top of Cable Mountain, Table Mountain. I didn't necessarily want to walk up there.
I'd done it before the test, and I'd done it before, and I knew how what a beautiful thing it is to do. And I kind of thought, I know you're not a man of peak physical fitness. You haven't got great aerobic capacity, shall we say. Great lung capacity.
That's fair.
Fantastic lung capacity. That much must be said. But you're more the broader aerobic side of things isn't really your bag. So Vogesy saying I want to go up Table Mountain. You having said it to me, I played matchmaker. Next morning, first thing, you're climbing up a mountain with a man who, until a few months earlier, was a professional athlete. How did that go for you?
Look, it was it went okay for me because we went at my pace. It probably didn't go so well for him because it took him about 4 hours longer than he was anticipating. But he was very patient. It just waited for me at every turn. And if you'd said, like, you know, who are the super fit cricketers, you kind of David Warner types and so on, you wouldn't necessarily have thought of Adam Voges as being a supreme athlete. You know, he sort of batted a bit and potted around out there, but my lord, he was fast up that mountain. So that does link to this, because if we had got lost while going up that mountain, had we been lost and had we had Azolio, we would have been able to send a text-based message or an email to anyone anywhere in the world saying that we were lost. We'd also be able to, I'm going to take this to the camera because why not, see this SOS little flap there, and you open it and there's a red button that says SOS. That is not a button that you press and Sean Marsh appears. That is a button that you press and help will come to you. It's not to say that Sean Marsh couldn't help. Sean Marsh might be there if Sean Marsh was
he was there in Cape Town services. I'm sure.
Yeah, when they pressed the SOS button in 2014, you know, after a couple of early wickets and he came in and made 148, he was responding to that SOS. So, you know, there's the emergency function, or there's just the, you just want to chat to someone because you're on top of Table Mountain and you don't have any phone reception because you're a tourist and you don't have a local phone number. And so what the magic little box does is it turns your phone into a satellite phone. It connects it to the satellite network and then you can just text anyone in the world. It's free. Once you've signed up your little plan, you send the messages for free, emails, texts, anywhere in the world, from anywhere in the world, off your own phone. Magic.
It is. There's a way of going over Table Mountain and continuing and sort of camping all the way across the top from one end to the other. And I believe it takes like eight days or something like that. You'd want to have Azolio for that. You'd also want to have Azolio if you were going to join us on the Final Word Cricket Tour, which has a new destination after today. But next year, we're going to go to Pakistan somehow. One way or another, we're going to go to Pakistan and we're going to go play some cricket over there. And I'm telling you, we're going to pack Azolio or two for that adventure because we might get right off the beaten track. So get one now. Why wait until you're playing with the Final Word 11? Why wait until you're being dragged into a cricket game many miles from anywhere? Get one now, Azolio.com, and do the preparatory work in 2021.
If you want to be able to text someone from the dance floor of the Dera Ismail Khan disco, you are going to need Azolio. It may not have a revolving floor like Frankston. I cannot speak to that. I don't know yet what the disco will look like. But when you're over there, you'll want to be able to send a text. That's all I'm saying. And if you have this, you can send that text from anywhere in the world to anywhere in the world. Zoleo.com. They make a good thing. Go and have a look.
Hi, I'm Ian Chappell. You're listening to The Final Word with Adam Collins and Jeff Lemon.
This is The Final Word with Jeff Lemon and Adam Collins, and we're joined by a cast of thousands for this interview. Well, a cast of three, but that makes five, which is quite a lot of people to have together in a conversation for the most part. We're delving into the story of Brazilian cricket. We were put onto this by Alistair Townsend, one of our listeners who's involved over there, and we're talking today to Roberto Moretti, the captain of the Brazil women's team, and Matt Featherstone, who's the head of Cricket Brazil, amongst other titles, and lives out there and has done for a while. Now, first of all, welcome to the show, everybody.
Many thanks. Great to be here.
Thank you very much, guys. Very good to be here with you this morning.
I suppose the story that drew us in from Alistair was initially about the way that Cricket Brazil awarded central contracts to 14 women's players and made the decision, a bit like the Thailand Cricket Federation made, that backing their women's team was going to move faster and bear fruit more readily than backing their men's team, which is a nice turnaround from the attitudes we see from most established boards where men's cricket comes first, second, third, through to about 19th, and then maybe women's cricket comes in after that. I guess maybe Matt, to start us off, you could tell us about how that came about, how central contracts came about, how the ability to offer central contracts came about, and your involvement in that dating back a couple of decades.
Well, I mean, initially, I think the surprise for a lot of people with the central contracts in Brazil, for the women's team first, was a surprise for many. But for us, because we were very fortunate that the cricket's always been a sport for all, we've come in with a fairly blank piece of paper with cricket. So there's no protocols that it's a men's sport, it's a women's sport. So we actually have as many women playing in Brazil as we do men. So that's a great start. So when we're already on an even playing field with numbers, potentially we just saw that the ability with the women was growing quicker. The ability for the women to proceed in the world of women's cricket, we thought would be cricket quicker. So therefore, us making that decision, putting the sort of our best team forward, and they are our best team, our most successful team, we thought that would make the biggest impact as quick as possible. And it is. I think it's proven. We've had central contacts for a year now, and we are really looking forward to getting out there playing against some countries after the pandemic and showing the ability of the national women's team here.
And having cricket set up in Brazil in the first place, you played a key part in that. Can you give our listeners the Cliff Notes version of those early days and how it came about?
Cricket's actually been around in Brazil since 1872, so I wasn't definitely the one that brought it over here. What we actually decided was in from about 2001, when we put the association together and we joined the ICC in 2006, was how we make cricket for Brazilians. It's always been an expat sport. Our idea was then, let's go out, give people the opportunity to play cricket. And as we know, it's the best game in the world. So why would Brazilians not like it? They've just missed out on the opportunity of being able to play it. Now they've got that opportunity. And therefore, taking that on, we had the bonus of them having a Brazilian game that they played in the streets called Taco, which is a similar form of cricket. And so we took that on, we introduced it, and why wouldn't they be good? Absolutely, there's a real chance that now they are playing, that we see that the Brazilian national team will grow up the rankings and will continue to grow.
Yeah, it's interesting seeing the game of Taco and how that corresponds with, I suppose, other countries around the world in the 1800s that had a big cricket influence courtesy of the British, I suppose. But this is a slightly different slant on that. Can you go into, perhaps Roberto, can you go into a bit of detail about what Taco is, how it's played, and how kids growing up might have played that game without necessarily knowing what cricket is?
It's very common here in Brazil to see kids playing the streets. For my generation, one of the most common game was taco. So all you need is a couple of bottles, a tennis ball, whatever piece of wood you find, and it's just like this fun game that everybody used to play. So it doesn't matter where you are in Brazil, if you're here, if you're in the seaside, if you are in big cities, everybody plays taco. They have different names across the country, but it is like this feeling of being the best taco player in the street that everybody's always chasing. So everybody was the best one in their street, regardless of who you're talking to. And it brings like great memories. So when I actually got to see cricket for the first time, that's when I realized where taco came from. I didn't know there was a sport that was related to taco before. And when you see cricket, you start seeing the relations of the wickets, hitting the stumps, being caught and things like that. So I guess all kids play a form of street cricket in Brazil, and it's a game that makes everyone very happy and makes everyone bring those childhood memories with a lot of affection, and is actually related to cricket.
And there's this beautiful intersection, I suppose, with you, Matt. So, I mean, when you arrive after your professional cricketing career at Kent finishes a couple of decades ago, but you press fast forward to about 10 years ago, and you're able to kind of tap into taco whilst at the same time advancing the cricket that you know from back home, and doing it all in underprivileged areas where you think there might be a chance to do something more. It's not just about cricket, but it's about the social development of the area as well.
Absolutely. I think the whole idea of us using cricket was just a way of us using something that we knew that we could do and could take to others, and taking cricket to the underprivileged areas around town. And unfortunately, in Brazil, there's quite a lot of underprivileged areas. We saw that cricket was just a tool that how we could get into these people and teach them a few more life skills and teach them a bit more about discipline, about respect, about family values, and cricket was our tool for that. Things have moved on a lot now, and I'm sure we'll talk about it with the university programs and the numbers of kids playing, but our first movement was really just taking cricket to people, knowing that it's a great sport and the values that cricket has.
So, Roberto, when did you first encounter cricket, and how did it draw you in? Was it quick? Did it take a while? Like, what was it that made you think, this is what I want to keep doing, you know, not just something I'm doing for a short time?
Well, I got married to an Englishman,
That helps.
It does help. And we moved to Brazil in the same city that Matt was living. And he was invited to teach cricket to these kids in the project as well. And we had a softball game on every Monday night. It convinced me to go one of these nights. And I think what caught my eye first was the environment. It was a very good environment to be in. So we had this happy place, fun place, that everybody was playing sport and enjoying themselves. And because I came from a very competitive sport environment, from the golf competitions, I think that really made me relax and enjoy the sport. And then what really made me say that I wanted to be involved in that sport, I want to play it, was what Matt said, the values. I think good sport with good values make you actually be part of it. So I think that's what made me stick in cricket and take it for a much longer period of time.
And in terms of how this goes on this upward rise, Matt, the work you're doing in Poços de Caldas, I hope I've pronounced that correctly, the social project you're working on, and cricket's a big part of that. When do you realise, as part of that, that there might be something here, that it's not just about what you're doing with those kids in underprivileged areas, but there might be something more there? By that I mean there could be an escalation, it could be a chance for Brazil to advance through the world rankings and eventually be in a position to pay their players and have these far loftier ambitions, which we'll talk about in a bit.
Now, obviously, when we started with 26 children in the orphanage, which was the first place that we took cricket to in the town, we never were thinking down the line of having central contracts of professional players of the national team. It was just simply providing an environment, as Roberta said, that was a fun environment, a pleasant environment to spend your time, and not only just pleasant, that they'd learn and play a little bit of cricket. That was how it started. Just having a couple of hours of fun each week with a group of people from the children's home.
Mm.
You say, as this grew on and went through, we've gone from 24 to 4,800 each week. And to be honest, if it wasn't for the pandemic, we'd be looking at bringing those numbers a lot, lot higher. We realised that as the fun sessions started with the tennis ball and with softballs, that there was actually potential there. And we started an under-13 team, an under-17 team. When you start looking at these children think there's actually good cricketers playing here. This is not just the fun and the fun part of the cricket. There's actually people with a bit of potential. And that started taking on to the next step. Really, the pathway of cricket came from nothing that was studied in 2009, 2010. It was just a progression of seeing people spend time, get better. Some of the kids never wanted to move into a hardball situation, which was fine. We've got children here that play softball cricket for 10 years, and that's great. We've got others from the 4,000 that say, no, we want to play the next level. And as you say, we've now grown to a situation where we've got kids that are actually very talented, the women's team and the under-19s team. I think in a little bit of time, we could have professional players travelling from Brazil, going to other countries, playing cricket professionally in other countries, coming back, representing Brazil, being role models in their communities, which is really important for us, because that was really how cricket changed. And not playing our part down, but having a load of expats or myself or Richard go to a community as an Englishman that played a little bit of cricket, and you probably built me up too much saying an ex-professional Kent cricketer because I was very average second team player. But anyway, we then realised that going to these communities, the reality of myself and Richard was a reality that they liked, but it wasn't their reality. They were looking at two expats that have been brought up in a different country talking about a game that they used to play. When we realised and started with locals that we picked up as our black T-shirts, and that was our first programme, we had the black T-shirt programme, they became the role models. And once Brazilians that lived in the community were telling other Brazilians in the community that this is a great game, this has got a future, there's a pathway, there's a university program, it became a reality. And the numbers, to be honest, grew massively, because they were looking at their friends from the local neighborhood saying, well, if they can do it, so can I. This is not just a one-off opportunity. This is a whole lifestyle that we could go into. And whether they become coaches or professional players or just become people that play softball cricket in this pleasant environment, it's an environment that people want to be involved in. So we actually had to bring the numbers down, because we had more numbers and we didn't have enough coaches to deal with the numbers. we're now in that process of creating coaches because, as I say, we've got people to play. We just haven't at the moment got the number of coaches to deal with the demand.
I'm interested in the physicality of cricket because the action of bowling is not a very natural action. The action of batting, the way you hit the ball is not the way that, if you give a kid a bat and tell them to hit a ball, they won't hit it in the way that a cricketer would. And if you're teaching kids from a young age to do it, then they get used to it. And once you start to get used to it, then, every cricketer walks around the house bowling imaginary deliveries and so on. It starts to feel natural after a while. But I'm interested, Roberto, as someone who didn't play cricket, you weren't learning it as a child, how it feels to be sort of teaching your body to do something completely different or learning that your body can do something that you didn't know that it could do before.
Well, I hit a lot of golf shots. it's a good question because I started cricket at an old age. I started when I was 27, 28. I have always been an athlete and I always taught my body things that it should learn, but cricket is different. But you're able to adapt. You're able to learn. It could take a little bit of time because, as you said, it's not normal. You're going to feel muscles in your body that you never felt. You're going to feel pain places that you never thought existed. But I think now that we have more and more coaches, more and more people doing it, the kids can relate and learn much quicker. When we started, we didn't have many people. It was a question of a lot of patience, a lot of practice, and a lot of effort from your body to learn that. Our bodies are very smart. It learns, it adapts. And if you have the willingness to learn it, it will get into it. One thing that is very interesting is like in Brazil, we develop a lot of, we develop mainly four or five sports only. And these five sports are great, but we have 200 million people in Brazil. And a lot of people are not gonna fit in these four or five sports. So cricket comes as a new gap for them to say, you know what, I don't have skills to play football, but I actually have skills to play cricket, and gives them another option of sport to be played as it should be. Because we have a lot of talent across the country, I would just have to put another option for them of what they can do.
Yeah, and this is where it gets really interesting, isn't it? So all these talented young prospective cricketers or who may or may not have picked up the game the way you have, Roberto, or maybe they've picked it up through the program that Matt's running in the schools, or maybe it's through the orphanage, whatever it takes to get there, we arrive at a place where there are pockets of Brazil where more cricket is being played than football, which just seems staggering to me, Matt. Can you tell that story? And it's a story of pride for the local mayor as well.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the good things about cricket is the local community have bought into this. They've seen the benefits of it. And the local governor, who's never been a cricket player, is our biggest fan. local government are falling over themselves to help us, which is fantastic. And as I say, I was at a presentation a couple of weeks ago. They were opening a new five-a-side football pitch. And his opening speech as the mayor was, "This is a great game. You would have thought this is the Brazilian national game, but in our city, we've got more people that play cricket than play football." and it's great because everyone in the turns up and thinks, "What's cricket?" And if they've never heard of it, and especially people from neighbouring towns that have not heard of it, then start to get interested. And our mayor is one of our biggest sales pitch, because when I go and speak to other mayors, and we've actually closed deals with all the other local towns around us, for them to then put cricket on the community projects as well. So he sells it for us. It's brilliant.
And in terms of that local engagement you referred to before, I mean, I love the idea of the black T-shirt program where these coaches aren't necessarily you. I mean, you're not relying on expats. That has been a criticism, I suppose, of some developing nations, associate affiliate nations, is that they rely so heavily on expats that it can be difficult to develop a local cricketing culture, which means that it's not necessarily sustainable in the longer term. But you've got the complete opposite approach where you're almost, as an administrator, hands off and allowing the cricket side of things to be people who've gone through your program, learnt the game, and now can teach the game.
Absolutely. As I say, to make this a national game, you've got to have nationals playing it. It was a massive thing for us that we wanted to get Brazilians teaching and playing the game and in the game. So, yeah, we every week we sort of take a step back and they take over a bit more. We haven't got an expat in our women's team. They're all Brazilians. In our under-19s, there's no expats. Not saying we don't want expats, and we think they play an important part in Cricket Brazil, but sure, they don't play as an important part in the national teams. We want nationals really putting the Brazilian shirt on, feeling proud to play in Brazil, and that does our marketing for us. One thing pushes another.
So part of what you've put together with this, the coaching program, the Black T-Shirt program, is putting those coaches through university as well. Is that partly to sort of offer an extra incentive to get involved, or is it so they can justify doing this when speaking with their families or so on, that they're getting something extra out of this than just playing a strange game that English people play?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. It does. The strange game, just to go off the subject, I realised how strange it was when I first arrived in Brazil and started talking about what a great game cricket was, and it lasted for a day or 5 days. And you'd look at people's faces and you'd realise that there was only one strange person in the room, and it was you. It wasn't them. But going back to the university programme, it was a strange thing, because the families, actually, were the hardest people to convince were the families. I spent more time with the families convincing them that this was a great idea for their children to do, because as we know, being part of cricket is great. The chance to play professional cricket is great, but if you can get a university degree behind you, that will change your life whether you play cricket or not. And therefore, opportunity was an opportunity that we thought we could offer to people. Of course, we'd love them to come and work for us, but that's not the guaranteed agreement. The agreement is they take part in a cricket scheme, they teach cricket to the local community, they do the university, and potentially they come and work for us. If that changes and they go and work for somebody else and their life has been made better through this program, well, that's the goal we're aiming at. We're not actually aiming at just making coaches. It's been great. They are the first people in their families that have ever been to university, which is a strange thing. You think you talk about university to the families and the uncles and aunties, they're saying, why would you do that? They go and learn for another 4 years. None of us have done this before, so is it a good thing? We are slowly breaking that barrier and finding out, and they're finding out, that it actually opens a lot more opportunities for them.
These younger players who are coming through, you're leading them now. You're the captain for this team, and it must be quite exciting to be taking players overseas for the first time, or you know, needing to look after them, I guess, as they come up into this national setup.
Yes, it's actually very interesting, because when I started this journey, I was in the same level as they were in terms of cricket, but it was a different age. So these kids were very young. They're coming from social projects. They're traveling for the first time. They were learning things. So you become this role model for them, not because of the cricket skills, but because you become the role model, because you're the person that they look after as a reference, because you're older, because you have lived these things before. So it actually brought me a sense of responsibility that I didn't think I was going to have in cricket. It felt very good, and also felt like I should use that responsibility for good. So learn how to be better for them, and learn how to teach them skills that would help them for life. So it is interesting. I had a nickname of the Big Mom at the start because of that. Yes, because the girls were so young, and I had the age to be their mom. Now, with this new setup, with the central contracts coming, I think I'm less of a mom and more of a person that they can talk to in terms of things of life and cricket things. So it is very rewarding to be in this position for the new generation of cricketers that are coming from Brazil.
And the team's really on the march as well. I mean, you've done really well in the South American Women's Championship over the last 5 or 6 years, winning that fairly sort of routinely and taking that next step. And it sort of made me think about two things, and the Irish example stands out in my mind on this. When they were taking their big step perhaps 15 years ago, it was about facilities and it was about not so much kit with them. They were able to get the supplies, but it was where is cricket going to be played? Where is the high performance centre going to be? And these sort of practical questions they needed to answer, and a lot of countries have had to answer as they make it through, because obviously cricket's a sort of sport where you need a lot of space and a lot of equipment. So perhaps if we can tell that story a bit as well, where are you playing these games of cricket? How are you developing? Is it turf pitches, hard wicket pitches, a combination of the two? Or something different altogether, and how you're getting the equipment and developing equipment. Because I know with Vanuatu, for example, that was a fascinating story with a bat maker in Melbourne. But have you been allied with different groups around the world who are supplying you with materials?
Yeah, I mean, firstly, with the Irish store, we've got a great advantage over the Irish that we don't have to worry about when the next sunny day is going to come. we've got plenty of sunshine. We don't have to worry about the rain. So we're already on the advantage of most of the world. When it comes to playing, we've started off using just any facility. We use tennis courts, basketball courts to start the social projects and community projects. We now, through work with the local government, they've provided us grounds to use. They are concrete pitches with AstroTurf wickets over the top. Mm. Quite at the stage where we've got people that can look after proper grass wickets at the moment, but who knows, that's one thing that could come on. As far as equipment goes, it's a massive difficulty for us. And as you know, we've partnered with the Lord's Taverners, who have done some fantastic work around the world and specifically with us. We actually received the largest shipment of Lord's Taverners equipment they've ever done. And that was brought over here. That made a real difference and was a real game changer for us to put bats and balls in people's hands of high quality. So we've actually set up our own bat factory now. We've actually made our own cricket bat factory in this town. We've got two people working for us that are making cricket bats. The reason for that is they're not going to be the high quality bats that the first team and the national team are using, but they are going to be the bats that are going to be the first bat for the person who starts a project in a street that can actually take home his own local bat and be proud of it. And that's something we wanted to do. We wanted to make sure that if we're going to get this out to Brazilians, we can't rely on bats being imported every 6 weeks or every 3 weeks from England or India to here. So we've opened up our own cricket bat factory, and that's going well.
Yeah, and that Lord's Taverners parcel or crate, I suppose it was, wasn't it? Shipping container. Yeah. Sorry, that's the word I'm looking for. Alistair actually told us about that before we started this conversation. That in itself comes with a pretty amazing story. And now there are kids in your town wearing the playing shirts of former international cricketers.
Absolutely. I mean, the container that the Lord's Taverner sent over was a complete game changer for us. It was, as I say, we'd received pallets or bats and balls we'd never seen. Imagine opening a container and seeing it completely full of cricket equipment. Logistically, that was a nightmare, but thankfully other people have bought into the project, and the British ambassador actually brought it over as his own personal container. So that helped massively. Amazing. I walked around town and as I say, Liam, who's on that head coach, who's from Devon, the first shirt he saw walking past was Overton from Somerset, and he's walking down the road and he's seeing Stuart Broad's shirt walking around, and he said, we live in quite a small community, and seeing the England shirts that come round, the county shirts, is fantastic. It really is great.
One of the interesting points about what to do next, you know, you're talking about growing the program sustainably and so on. But when it comes to the Olympics and cricket, it's been, as far as the top cricket countries go, it's been this very self-indulgent conversation that they've been sort of kicking back and forth for about 30 years, saying, should we have cricket in the Olympics? Oh, well, it might clash with this and that, and oh, it might be more trouble than it's worth. And then you look at the role that would play in for countries like Brazil and so many of the smaller associate countries who get so little ICC funding to rely on, and the Olympics could be the most important change in cricket, and yet it's one that keeps being delayed. Can you explain to us what that Olympics of ambition is and what the difference is that it could make?
Absolutely. So the Olympics is so important for the 90-odd associate members that sit below the full members. I understand, and as you know, I work with the ICC as the global representative. The people I represent, which are the associates, would cry out for it to be an Olympic sport. It would be something that would change specifically the funding model. The funding model of the ICC is split and helps massively, but with the Olympic participation, that could really change. That you get internal support, you get a buy-in from your local government, and it's the one thing that when associates and when Brazil go and talk to the local government, the first question that comes back is, are you an Olympic sport? Can you have Olympic funding? And unfortunately, as you say, this is being thrown around the boardroom table with the top countries. We are just hoping that in 2028 or 2029, when it may be, that cricket will be an Olympic sport in the USA. We will have a chance to at least try and participate. But what it will do, it will open funding from national governing bodies to be able to help out cricket grow in Brazil.
And I suppose that just that passion for Olympic sports in Brazil, right? Like there's that fervour around any Olympic sport, as I understand it, in your part of the world, so that it's not just the part of Brazil that currently is playing it where you are, but suddenly you're having a very different conversation with young kids around the country that they can be an Olympian for Brazil and have that extraordinary privilege.
Yeah, and it's something that everyone dreams about. It's one of those sports that, or one of those competitions that to be a part of is probably every sporting person's dream. And therefore, if cricket could be part, and Brazilians not only have got a chance to take part, but a chance to do well. They've got a chance to shine. It gives them that next goal. It gives them that next pathway point to aim for. And really, I think it's a great possibility for a lot of associate countries. And we've seen Thailand women jump up into the World Cup. Well, they'd be someone who'd be perfectly fitting into an Olympic scenario, an Olympic sport. It would just open up more doors for more countries.
And we've heard about the expansion of both of the World Cup formats as well by a couple of places. So is that something that piques your interest, that maybe you might be able to qualify for a T20 World Cup at, say, the later end of this decade?
The aim is that. We definitely feel that that's what we're striving after. National teams are training hard. Obviously, the national teams are training hard, but seeing the progression of how, especially women's sport, is progressing. Who would imagine that in 2020, 86,000 people would have been at the MCG to watch the women's final? It's something that 10 years ago, we all know that they put the women's game a couple of hours before the men's game just to try and get a few early participants turning up to watch the game. Now, the women's game on its own is filling out a stage of that capacity. So things are definitely changing. We definitely feel that there is a chance that Brazil can be part of this, and not just Brazil. There are so many other associate nations that many people don't even know play, apart from the top 12 full countries. If you speak to a lot of cricketing countries, they don't know that Argentina, Peru, Chile have got national teams and are doing well. And I think that whole thing of the Olympics coming in, that will open the door for all of these countries that are less known to make a name for themselves.
Roberto, your team in the shorter term, you've gone from 32nd in the rankings to 27th. What's coming up the next couple of assignments for you, and what are your ambitions with that team in the shorter term?
I think our biggest ambition is the qualifiers for the World Cup. We have the regional qualifiers coming up this year, and we want to do very well in it. I think this is the first goal that we have, the first and probably the most important goal that we have at this moment. And we want to play more. I know the pandemic is playing a big part of it. So it's not allowing us to travel. It's not allowing us to play more games against better teams. But that's our intention for the soon near future, to be able to play more against more competitive teams and be prepared for the qualifiers.
And when can we come and watch you play? When can we get a delegation of Final Word listeners to watch the Brazil women play? Because I've got a feeling after listening to this interview, you're going to have recruited a great many new fans.
Well, I believe the next time that everybody's going to be able to watch us is going to be in the qualifiers. All the will be broadcasted.
Right.
So I think that's the next option that we have, which is going to be in September, planned for September. And hopefully, we will be allowed to travel sometime soon and be able to play against teams in Europe, teams in South America, and have these games available for you guys.
And that's a wonderful thing, isn't it, that this new broadcasting arrangement the ICC have committed to just in the last couple of weeks means that there'll be quite a few Brazil women's games that we're going to be able to watch live as a stream that never would have been the case even a couple of years ago. This is new and important territory in terms of your exposure and commercialising it, winning sponsors, all that kind of thing.
I think that's great for the women's game. I think the community is asking for more women's sports. They are asking to see these women cricket players. The gap is over there for us to use it. So I think that's great that we're going to be able to show the world what these countries are doing. And you cannot be what you cannot see. So the more people see women's games, more they will want to play women's games. So women's sports. So I think that's going to be great.
Yeah, and speaking of funding, Matt, which I did in my previous question, I suppose every organisation that relies on a consistent revenue stream that's trying to grow and emerge has been hit by COVID-19, and you'll be no different. You've got a new crowdfunding page that you've opened up recently, which we'll, of course, put into our show notes for this episode. But it is an important time to keep the momentum going in many ways, but that includes funding for you.
Yeah, funding, obviously, COVID has affected us massively. We're very fortunate that we've gone up the ICC rankings and therefore receive an ICC grant. But local funding, which we depend on with COVID, has been difficult. So this new gogetfunding.com site is something that we're looking at, as you say, to help the momentum, to not let things die down, and to keep providing people the opportunity to play cricket throughout this pandemic.
We've been extremely excited to learn about the a little bit more about the Cricket Brazil story, and we will be keeping an eye on it. Matt Roberto, good luck with it, and thanks for joining The Final Word.
Been fantastic. Really appreciate your time. Please keep looking us up, because good things are going to keep happening here. This is the start of something new, and we really feel that every year things are going to get better and better. And so maybe we'll have The Final Word come to see Cricket Brazil, or we can have a few more final words in the future to tell you what's happening.
Much guys, it was a pleasure to be here with you, and keep following us in the social media. And it's going to be a pleasure for us to share our stories and be with you more often.
Hi, I'm Isha Gua, and you're listening to The Final Word with Adam Collins and Jeff Lemon.
This is The Final Word with Jeff Lemon and Adam Collins. Thank you to Roberta and Matt for taking the time to speak with us about cricket in Brazil. Our next stop on the is that on the way to Pakistan, or do we go to Pakistan first?
Yeah, I wonder
in charge of travel arrangements. Yeah,
how would it work if we're going? Well, let's assume the trips we're triangulating Pakistan. Mm. I'm coming from UK, you're coming from Australia. Yep. I'll take the high road, you'll take the low road, and I'll be at Dera, Ismail Khan before you. We'll work on that. But Brazil and Pakistan are both on the itinerary for 2022. Okay. Make no mistake.
All right. Yeah, I reckon maybe Pakistan first might be more conveniently located, but yeah, we'll figure that out on the way. We've got our last bit of correspondence, because we have been asking our audience for nominations for your favourite bannerman. That is to say, an innings that exceeds the 67.35% of the total team runs in a completed innings scored by Charles Bannerman in the first ever Test match. And we have a link to that first ever Test match that was sent in by Eamon Hark, first of all, Adam.
Yeah, he just wanted to point out that yesterday was the 144th anniversary since the first ever Test match, so at March 1877 at the Melbourne Cricket Ground. He adds that there are two incredible facts from that match. One is that Tom Horan was born in Cork, Ireland, and two, that Bransby Cooper was born in Dhaka, the capital of Bangladesh, both of his countries. So Eamon Hark, who is the Irish Bangladeshi, it was accounted for in the first Test match played 144 years ago this week, Jeff.
And as far as a Bannerman-like nomination, this one comes in from Anthony Radford, who says, I'm relying on memory a bit, as it was pre-digital and pre-my cricket. So we're now getting into sort of country pub furphy, this is how I kicked 7 points to win the game sort of territory. I was 16 or 17 playing A grade, says Anthony, in the early 90s for Broadford against Ngambi in the Seymour District Cricket Association. Ngambi was new in the league and had secured the services of the second best batsman in the comp as their captain coach, Barrel Barnes. I have forgotten his first name if I ever knew it. He was a big hitter who could take the game away in 10 minutes, and this was a pretty good league. We had a lot of former district players still making an impact. On this day, we got a couple of quick wickets, and I found myself bowling my offies to Barrel early in his innings. I was working on an arm ball and thought I would try it out. He was on one. I was super excited to see him nick it to our captain at first slip, only to see him put it down.
Oh.
Anyway, at the end of the innings, Barrel had hit 138 and Ngambi was bowled out for 160. What made things worse was our innings the next Saturday. I was at the non-striker's end, batting 8 or 9, telling the number 11 to get his body behind the ball. He tried to hit one out of the park, was clean bowled, and we lost by 4 runs. Barrel picked up 3 or 4 wickets.
Well, I just did a quick calculation then. That means that Barrel struck 86.3% of the runs, which is right up there in Glen Turner land.
That's a theme park you could open.
Yeah, Glen Turner land is going
to
be there.
Welcome to Glen Turner land.
It's going to be put next to that hotel they have at Worcestershire. Maybe it can be next to the cathedral there at Worcestershire. It'd be a fitting tribute to the great New Zealander. But Anthony Radford, I want
it's
to see.
It's got to have an aquarium, like, because it's going to be underwater half the year.
That's true. I want to see some documentary evidence of this, Anthony. He's a resourceful chap, Anthony Radford. That much we know. We know that he still is quite involved with cricket in that part of Victoria. I'm sure he can find a scorebook from the day that they played Ngambi back in the early 90s. I have faith in you, Anthony. Find it, digitise it.
It's got to be in the club archive.
Send it to us and we can verify the 138 out of 160, because if it is 86.3, that's nearing very special territory. We can't have that on spec. We need to know for sure.
Yeah, I will say that he said the score was about 160. So if it was, say, 164 or 166, it would lower the percentage
dramatically.
So, you know, these are fine margins, Anthony. We need to know what we're dealing with here. I think that's the show for today.
Yep.
The final word, Jeff Lemon, Adam Collins, this is what we do. Thank you to everyone for listening. Cbus Super and Zolio help keep the show on the park. You can add .coms to their respective names and find them on the internet. Look, you know how the internet works. You'll figure it out. Bad Producer Productions, they are our podcast label. There are lots of other nice shows on there as well that you can go and listen to. They're not about cricket. That would be weird if they were, but they're about all kinds of other things, because you can be a rounded human being and have more than one sort of interest. Mostly, thanks to everyone on the Patreon page, you actually are the lifeblood of the show. Dave Collins is the editor and has listened to us talk for the last however long it has been. And I think those are all of the people we need to credit today.
I think you're right. One parting thought is that we're just on the cusp of 600 patrons, Jeff, which is lovely. We talked on Storytime last week about trying to overtake James Anderson in terms of more patrons than wickets he has. I think he's got 614 test wickets at the moment. Help us reach Jimmy. May this be our last thought. If you've enjoyed what we've done across the first 2 million downloads, as it were, and you want to help us make it that we do 2 million
imagine
more.
If it's just one guy. Imagine if it's just one dude just out there just changing his IP address every day so the computer thinks it's a different computer, just downloading the show again. I really liked it the first time. I salute your endeavour, if so.
So help us catch up with Jimmy, and we'll have more on that kind of thing on Storytime on the weekend. That's it, Jeff. Let's say goodbye. See you later. Bye-bye. I had to go.